Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The world must accept that COVID-19 is with us for the foreseeable future, even if it is possible to end the acute phase of the pandemic this year, the UN Health Agency chief said on Monday. World Health Organization WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus was speaking in Geneva, where he noted that last week 100 cases of COVID-19 were reported every 3 seconds, and somebody lost their life to the virus every 12 seconds. It is still dangerous to assume that Omicron will be the last variant or that we are in the end game of the pandemic, he said, adding that globally, conditions are ideal for more variants to emerge. In an appeal to all countries, Tedros said that their top priorities should be to stop future health threats from taking hold, not least by promoting basic health care for everyone. On tackling the coronavirus specifically, Tedros urged better management of acute respiratory diseases in future via a sustained and integrated international platform. Staying with WHO, top agency officials warned on Monday about potential disruption to national vaccination campaigns as a direct result of willful misinformation about COVID-19 jabs and treatment. To tackle false information about the coronavirus, WHO encourages community and faith leaders everywhere to present an accurate and science-based view of the pandemic and its risks. Here's Dr. Maria van Kerkhove, WHO COVID-19 technical lead, speaking in Geneva.
This is a huge problem that we've been dealing with, not just with vaccines, but throughout this entire pandemic, and it continues to be a massive problem. Disinformation, misinformation kills, and it spreads faster than viruses, so we really need people to pass good information to each other.
The UN Health Agency also works with large social media platforms to issue warnings over posts that are not factual, based on policies that have been developed to target unfounded rumors. Dozens of prisoners linked to terrorists ISIL are believed to have escaped from a prison in northeast Syria following an attack involving explosions and gunfire, UN aid coordinator Ocha said on Monday. The targeting of Sinnar jail in Al-Hasakeh city on Thursday follows multiple previous attacks and riots, although this was the largest incident yet. In an update, Ocha said that airstrikes and gunfire had been reported in neighborhoods close to the prison and that a total lockdown was announced in the city on Sunday. With hostilities confined to southern areas and unconfirmed reports of civilian casualties, the UN Humanitarian Office said that around a dozen aid trucks on their way to warehouses in Qamishli are stranded in Al-Hasakeh City or at Araka. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, search corporate news media for recent stories on the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, in which some of the city's overwhelmingly black residents were paying upwards of $300 a month for water they couldn't even drink, based on an infrastructure decision on the water source that their elected officials had no say in. And you'll find a few reports on how, yes, lead leaching pipes endangered people's health, but there's been a multi-million dollar settlement and a presidential commitment to address lead in water, so maybe it's all over but the shouting. CNN hosted a Republican Michigan Congress member who explained that Flint was under an unelected, austerity-minded emergency manager because, quote, their city had essentially collapsed. They had no strong functioning government, and the state had to step in, and there was an error in shifting water sources, close quote. That sounds lamentable, but not really blameworthy. So how do you square that, sorry, but let's move forward line with the information that investigators looking into the crisis found that the cell phones of key health officials and other players like then-Governor Rick Snyder's press secretary had been wiped of messages for the key period? While corporate media have largely let Flint go, the story isn't over, nor has justice been served. We'll hear from a reporter still on the case, Jordan Sheraton from independent news network Status Quo News. Also on the show, you don't need to put your ear to the ground to hear U.S. news media drumbeats for war of some sort with official enemies China and or Russia. With China, part of what we're being told to two-minute hate is their involvement on the African continent, where we're to understand they are nefariously trapping countries in debt, unlike the U.S. involvement in the region, which has been about bringing joy and love and hope. Just because a playbook is old doesn't mean it won't be used again and again. That vision relies on amnesia and ignorance of what the U.S. has done and is doing in sub-Saharan Africa, a topic that, if news media wanted to explore it, well, they had a great chance this past week with the 60th anniversary of the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the first elected prime minister of Democratic Republic of the Congo. Why was Lumumba killed? And what is the living legacy of that undercovered murder? We'll hear from Maurice Carney, co-founder and executive director of the group Friends of the Congo. That's coming up this week on Counterspin, brought to you every week by the Media Watch Group Fair. In an op-ed for The Hill a year ago, Michigan Representative Dan Kildee called the 2014 decision to switch the source of Flint, Michigan's drinking water, quote, one of the greatest environmental injustices in our lifetimes, close quote. That may be true, but the environment didn't do it. The Flint crisis was and is a crisis of democracy. Decision-making had been taken out of the hands of Flint's elected officials and given to an emergency manager tasked with reining in costs, a process that seems to be used disproportionately in communities of color, taking decisions out of community hands, but leaving them to deal with their fallout. The Flint story reflects malfeasance, austerity politics, and punishing indifference to the lives of black and brown people, as well as the limits of news media's attention span. Evidence suggests most big media have either swallowed the Pollyanna line that the Flint water crisis is over and justice served, or else the nihilist line that Flint was really no worse than lots of other places, so what are you going to do? But some journalists have not stopped seeing the ongoing community harms resulting from decisions carried out by real people with names and addresses as worthy of pursuit. We're joined now by Jordan Cheriton, investigative reporter and the CEO of independent news network Status Quo News. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Jordan Cheriton.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, the story has some twists and turns and a lot of players, individual and institutional. Folks can listen to previous interviews to get some of the early issues, but I'd like to ask you to bring us up to date. What are the latest developments in efforts to hold officials accountable for what was not an accident, but a crime, and one with real and ongoing effects?
Yeah, so unfortunately, the latest efforts seem to be inadequate based on my reporting, but the current Attorney General of Michigan, Dana Nessel, and her prosecution team, which basically is the second Flint investigation in 8 years. There was an original investigation team launched under the previous Michigan Attorney General. They investigated from 2016 through 2018. And then when the current Attorney General, Nessel, came in, she basically fired that team and restarted the whole investigation. That new investigation charged Governor Snyder last year with a misdemeanor for his role in the water crisis. My reporting over the years has indicated there was a whole lot more there than a misdemeanor. And my reporting actually showed that the original Flint water investigators who were fired by the current attorney general, they were actually building a case against the governor for involuntary manslaughter. So they were going much more aggressively against the governor than the current prosecution team ended up doing. They only charged him with a misdemeanor. There's been some other charges against state and city officials. Nothing has gone to trial yet. Currently, the governor, former Governor Rick Snyder, and other defendants are trying to get the charges tossed, basically claiming that the prosecution team made errors in how they collected and distributed evidence. So right now, it's kind of stuck in delays. And, you know, big picture, we're now heading into year 8 in April. No one has been convicted. No one is in jail. The people of Flint are still suffering. Residents are getting sicker and sicker as the years go on. I think that's something people don't realize, the effects of heavy metal poisoning. It gets worse as the years goes on. So residents I speak with developing cancers that they had no family history for, liver issues, kidney issues, bone issues, autoimmune issues, and of course the children, learning disabilities, behavioral problems, you know, all sorts of things. So it's still very much a crisis. And, you know, in my view, the media has totally abandoned this and abdicated their responsibility to cover it and treat it as an ongoing crisis.
Well, yeah, let me just start from there, because it seems to me that media didn't just stop covering Flint. They kind of declared it over. You know, they kind of said, it's fixed. You've been working with Detroit Metro Times, with The Intercept, and since the start, it seems like local media have done more and done better and done deeper than big media. But in big national media, it's almost not like it's over. It's like, oh, no, it worked out, you know, and that couldn't be more wrong, you're saying.
Yeah, if I write a book one day, the media will be a big part of it, because honestly, they're as complicit in the cover-up as the politicians at this point. Actually, if I roll back to 2018, you know, the media at that point was just basically regurgitating the data that then-Governor Snyder and his team were putting out there, data that showed the lead levels were dramatically falling and that the levels were now, quote-unquote, you know, meeting EPA regulations. But I was hearing from residents and sources that they basically manipulated the testing and the data. So I did something radical these days for a journalist, and I went to Flint, and I just started knocking on doors. Mm-hmm. And myself and, at the time, my previous reporting partner, we knocked on nearly 500 doors in the summer and fall of 2018. And what we discovered was that the state of Michigan Environmental Department was literally running residents' water right before taking lead and copper samples. Like just a few minutes before taking the sample, they were running water, which is against EPA regulations. So voila, they were getting low lead levels because they were basically flushing away potential lead. I was actually working on that story for Newsweek, trying to get it in a bigger national outlet with the hope of it getting, you know, getting traction. Newsweek literally killed the story the week it was supposed to be published, claiming we didn't have enough data. even though we had dozens and dozens of examples on the record, residents on the record, that state officials had run their water before testing or told them to run their water before testing. So we ended up self-publishing it, but even in 2018, it was very clear that the way they were testing was completely wrong and borderline just cooking the data. So when you see stories from Reuters and elsewhere that 3,000 other cities have higher lead levels than Flint, I was screaming, well, we don't really know what the real lead levels are in Flint because there was no integrity in the testing. Aaron Brockovich actually, when our story came out, said this is a crime. It's falsifying lead and copper samples. That's a crime, and the testing should be tossed out. So since then, the testing has still been inadequate. They're not even testing as many homes as they should be in Flint, and they haven't even changed all of the busted pipes. So how can you say the water's safe if 8 years later they haven't even replaced all the pipes? They haven't touched the pipes inside their home, which were already damaged. So this is your classic example of, you know, the media got caught up in kind of the five-year Trump circus. A lot of other stories fell through the cracks, and the media, national and local, just basically regurgitated falsified data that was being fed to them by the very state government that presided over the poisoning. And to tell you the truth, the current Democratic governor, Gretchen Whitmer, and the current Democratic attorney general haven't really done much better. There's really been this push to declare it over, to claim that it's not an issue with the water anymore. The water's fine. Now it's just about rebuilding trust. Well, I was just in Flint over the summer. I could tell you, I spoke with residents who showed me rashes they are still getting from that water, hair loss. They're still losing hair when they shower. Residents describing their eyes burning in the shower. Anecdotally, I have sat in homes within the last year where the water stinks. So, you know, it's very easy for media in New York, D.C., on the West Coast to basically regurgitate what they're fed by the government. But it's a lot harder and more expensive, by the way, to actually go there and with your own eyes and talk to residents to find out, yeah, this is more of a narrative. This isn't actually reality that it's solved.
Well, let me just say, finally, maybe I know the answer. President Biden said just recently, I want you to know, I see you, I hear you, we understand, and I've seen and we've understood the damage done in places like Flint, Michigan, and Jackson, Mississippi. So we've already announced over $7 billion in clean water funding to states so they can fix and upgrade their aging water systems and sewer systems. What's your response to that kind of official declaration vis-a-vis human beings in Flint, Michigan?
Well, first of all, it's a nice slogan to say the infrastructure deal is going to deliver clean water and replace all pipes. The actual money earmarked to replace lead pipes is not enough to replace all lead pipes in the country. So that's number one. Number two, there's a misnomer that the only issue with water is lead. That's not the only issue contaminating our water. There's a lot of other contaminants in our water.
Right.
And a lot of those contaminants are coming from corporate and industrial pollution. So this was more of a marketing slogan and a messaging thing by Biden and the Democrats, not to say replacing some lead lines is, of course, better than nothing, but that's not going to completely fix the problem. And when you look at Flint specifically, why is it that Flint, Michigan, majority black, those residents don't have Medicare for All for being poisoned by their government? But when you look up to Libby, Montana, those residents, 96% white, they have universal health care because of an asbestos disaster that happened over a decade there where a lot of people died. They got universal health care in Libby, Montana. Your listeners should look that up. People of Flint, they don't have universal health care. They got a short-term expansion of Medicaid, and that's pretty much over now. I talked to residents who are nearly going bankrupt because of the bills they have for environmental doctors, because for heavy metal poisoning, a normal internist is not enough. You really need specific, specialized doctors. So the people of Flint, there's been a lot of woke language, and we hear you, and you know we're going to do everything for you. But if you talk to the people of Flint, they are still screaming for help. And real quickly, this is also a major problem with local media. I've broken at least four pretty significant stories on the Flint water cover-up over the last 2 years. The Flint Journal has not covered any of it. The Detroit Free Press has not covered any of it. The Detroit News has not covered any of it. And I literally have spoken with people from those outlets who have told me point blank, yeah, there's pressure from the top just to kind of not cover that anymore. So I have no idea why, but this is a national media failure, but it's also a local media failure, because the local media in Michigan has essentially continued this narrative that the water is fine now and that this is now, you know, let's move on.
We've been speaking with Jordan Cheriton, reporter and CEO at the independent news network Status Quo News. Thank you so much, Jordan Cheriton, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
We saw a good amount of media attention to Reverend Martin Luther King this past week, including, yes, the FBI pretending with a straight face that they are honoring his legacy, but also some acknowledgement of a point that we at FAIR make, that celebration of King today is often a whitewashing, avoiding discussion of many of his actual views, and that the news media, who are so full of bromides for King and his death, were working hard attacking and undermining him while he lived. Meanwhile, another anniversary that offered opportunity for reflection was utterly overlooked. January 17th marked 60 years since the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the first elected prime minister of the post-independence Democratic Republic of the Congo, a crime in which the U.S. played a significant role. In August of 1960, CIA Director Alan Dulles told the agency's station in Congo that it is the clear-cut conclusion that if Lumumba continues to hold high office, the inevitable result will at best be chaos and at worst pave the way to communist takeover of the Congo, with disastrous consequences for the prestige of UN and for the interests of the free world generally. Consequently, we conclude that his removal must be an urgent and prime objective. As corporate media bang the drums for a new or continued Cold War in Africa today, the story of Lumumba seems especially significant. But telling it openly would require a dry-eyed examination of U.S. actions and intentions that corporate news media are just not in the business of providing. We're joined now by Maurice Carney, co-founder and executive director of the group Friends of the Congo. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Maurice Carney.
It's a pleasure to be back with you, Jane.
Well, may I just ask you to talk a bit about January 1961 and the context for the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. The country is newly independent, but still in transition. Why was Lumumba considered such a danger?
Lumumba was considered a danger for several reasons. One, he was a nationalist and a Pan-Africanist. And as he articulated in his June 30th, 1960 inaugural speech, that he wanted the resources of the Congo to benefit the Congolese people. Anyone familiar with the creation of the Congo was created by European nations. It was created as an outpost for the extraction of natural resources to benefit Europe and the West. And Lumumba represented an end to that system. So that's one reason. Secondly, he was uncompromising in his critique of the colonial history in the Congo and really contemporary imperialism. And he was an anti-colonial fighter. So that also represented a problem. And so those two reasons, the critique that he brought against colonialism and imperialism, the uncompromising self-sufficiency, self-determination, and Pan-Africanism that he articulated indicated that he was someone that couldn't necessarily be controlled or owned or readily influenced by the West. So that posed a huge problem for the United States and European powers as well.
Well, I think the failure to even talk about the assassination today reflects in some ways just how important and how dangerous Lumumba was judged, so much so that we can't even explore it now. But his murder was important and inspired action.
Yeah, in fact, Professor Georges Nzengola Ntalaja argues that the assassination of Patrice Lumumba and it's one of the most important assassinations of the 20th century. Professor Nzongolo is now ambassador to the United Nations of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. He had written a book entitled Lumumba. So he articulated just the significance of Lumumba's assassination. In fact, even the chief of station of the CIA in the Congo, Larry Devlin, in a book with the same title, Chief of Station Congo, laid out how critical Lumumba was not only to the Congo, Janine, but to Africa at large. That is to say, Devlin shared and he intimated that we had to get rid of Lumumba because not only would we have lost the Congo, Lumumba would to stay and remain in power, but we would have lost all of Africa. So we see the centrality of Lumumba to not only post-independence Congo, but a post-independence Africa. And the president of Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah, articulated that and concurred with that, because in his book, The Challenge of the Congo, he shared how Congo would ultimately serve as the capital of Nkrumah's project, of the Pan-African project of the United States of Africa. So Congo, which is located in the heart of the African continent, arguably one of the richest countries on the planet in terms of natural resources, strategically located on the African continent, was vital to Nkrumah's Pan-African project. So it was a very critical country, and Lumumba was a Pan-Africanist who accepted and acknowledged the role that Congo would play in a self-determined, independent Africa.
Well, you and I talked at one point about how U.S. officials were saying, and this is just a few years ago, U.S. officials were saying and media were parroting the statement, Congo hasn't had a peaceful transfer of power since 1960, you know, without even pretending to explore why that is and what
right.
The U.S. role has been in that. And I just wonder if you could address the role of news media here in, I mean, it's mainly what they haven't done with regard to this, or what they have done. I don't know. Yeah.
And I think when we had this discussion, it was around the role that, if I'm not mistaken, I think it may have been Time magazine had played at the time in planting stories that were fed to them by the Central Intelligence Agency, in presenting Lumumba in a disparaging fashion, basically working hand in glove with U.S. foreign policy in destabilizing the Congo. So the media was, through its vocal means and at the time of Lumumba, they did play a destructive role, and today through its silence. We know, based on U.S. documents that were recently published, declassified documents that were recently published by the U.S. State Department, that the United States played a critical role in the destabilizing of the Congo, not only during the time of Lumumba, but right up until today. Declassified documents from the State Department say that at a time, the covert action in the Congo was the largest in the world by the United States government, and that for the first 10 years or so of Congo's independence, the Central Intelligence Agency had a role to play in who would lead the Congo. As you know, it went through several leaders. And, of course, the leader that wound up taking control of the country, Joseph Désiré Mobutu in 1965, was installed, backed, and maintained by the United States. So to the extent that we see instability in the Congo, that we see corruption, that we see a lack of security, the role the United States played in uprooting the nascent democratic process that began in that country with the election of Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba, that role by the United States is central, and it's something that unfortunately today's media has not taken up and articulated and shared with the American public in the way that it ought to or that it should.
Well, finally, right now, Patrice Lumumba's family is fighting for the return of his remains, such as they are. Listeners may not know his body was dissolved in sulfuric acid, but the demands go beyond that important repatriation. If we heard the voice of the Congolese people, not just Lumumba's family, but if we could hear the voice of Congolese people today, what would they be saying that we're not hearing?
Well, we, Friends of the Congo, honored the daughter of Lumumba during a Congo Week event, Juliana Lumumba, who has led the fight to have her father's remains repatriated to the country. And in her acknowledgement speech, she had a message for the Congolese youth. That is to continue the teachings, the ideas of Lumumba, to look at him as a model and example of sacrificing his life for a country and a continent. And Congolese youth today embrace that sentiment, particularly through their music. There are a number of Congolese musicians, hip-hop artists, who bring Lumumba's ideas and teachings to the current generation of Congolese. So they are actually embracing Lumumba's ideas, embracing Lumumba's teachings, the ideas of self-sufficiency, self-determination, Pan-Africanism. The Congolese youth have taken that up today, and they are sharing it with their current generation, and they're doing it through music, through art, through writing. So he is, especially in light, Janine, of the lack of strong leadership, not only in the Congo, but throughout the African continent, Lumumba is being fully embraced, fully shared, and being held up as a model for future leaders. So he's in good stead. And we acknowledge Lumumba ourselves through a campaign that's on Lumumba Day, lumumbaday.org, lumumbaday.org, where people throughout the world are joining up and saying they're going, even if the media doesn't speak about it, about Lumumba and his importance and significance, they're going to do so. And they're doing that from the platform of lumumbaday.org. Every January 17th, he's being held up, along with the colleagues who were assassinated with him, Maurice Mpolo and Joseph Okito. So his legacy is in very, very good standing with not only Congolese youth, but people throughout the globe.
We've been speaking with Maurice Carney, co-founder and executive director of the group Friends of the Congo. You can find them online at friendsofthecongo.org. Maurice Carney, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine. It's been my pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Pentagon's placed 8,500 troops on heightened alert to potentially deploy to Eastern Europe over concerns Russia may soon invade Ukraine. The U.S. and NATO allies have accused Russia of amassing 100,000 troops near the Ukrainian border, but Russia's denied it's planning an invasion. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki spoke Monday.
And we have a sacred obligation to support the security of our eastern flank countries. I think it's important to remember who the aggressor is here. It is not the United States. It is not these eastern flank countries. It is Russia, who has tens of thousands of troops on the border of Ukraine.
This comes as other NATO nations are planning to send additional troops, ships, and fighter jets to Eastern Europe. On Monday, the Kremlin accused the United States and NATO of escalating tension in the region. Meanwhile, negotiations to resolve the crisis are ongoing, with officials from Russia, Ukraine, France, and Germany scheduled to meet in Paris Wednesday. We'll have more on the crisis over Ukraine after headlines. The United States reported more than 2,100 COVID-19 deaths on Monday, even as daily cases and hospitalizations continued to decline from record highs set earlier this month. Here in New York, a judge ruled Monday Governor Kathy Hochul's statewide mask mandate for all indoor public places was enacted unlawfully and is now void. Supreme Court Justice Thomas Rademacher ruled that only lawmakers rather than the governor or health officials had the authority to enact the mask mandate. New York's Department of Health is planning an appeal. In Virginia, seven school districts have filed suit to block Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin's executive order making masks optional in schools. On Monday, the first of 400 million free N95 masks for the public began arriving at U.S. pharmacies after the Biden administration ordered them delivered from the Strategic National Stockpile. Former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin said Monday she's tested positive for coronavirus. Palin's announcement prompted a U.S. district judge in New York to delay the start of Palin's defamation trial against the New York Times, which was set to begin Monday. Palin has refused to be vaccinated against COVID-19, telling a conservative conference last month, quote, "It will be over my dead body that I'll have to get a shot," unquote. The New York Times reports that on Saturday, Palin dined indoors at Elio's Italian restaurant in Manhattan, despite a city ordinance requiring customers provide proof of vaccination. Burkina Faso's army leaders say they've deposed President Gaboure, suspended the Constitution, dissolved Parliament, and closed the nation's borders. In a broadcast on state television Monday, Lieutenant Colonel Paul-Henri Damiba was introduced as Burkina Faso's new leader. The African Union condemned the coup, as did leaders of the United Nations.
The Secretary General strongly condemns any attempted takeover of government by the force of arms. He calls on the coup leaders to lay down their arms and to ensure the protection of the physical integrity of the president and of the institutions of Burkina Faso.
A warning to our audience. The following story contains descriptions of sexual violence in Guatemala. Five former paramilitary soldiers have been convicted of crimes against humanity and sentenced to decades in prison for sexually assaulting dozens of indigenous Achi women in the 1980s. The historic ruling comes after years of advocacy by survivors and supporters. The women were not able to file criminal complaints of the atrocities until 2011. It then took over a decade for the former members of the so-called Civil Self-Defense Patrol to stand trial earlier this month. The patrol is made up of several armed groups recruited by Guatemala's U.S.-backed army. Survivors said the soldiers rounded up all the men in their village and disappeared them before raping and assaulting the women. One of the survivors who testified at the trial was only 12 years old when she was raped. In Mexico, another journalist has been assassinated in the northern border city of Tijuana. Lourdes Maldonado Lopez is the third journalist killed in Mexico this month. She was found fatally shot inside a car Sunday. In 2019, Maldonado went to Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador's daily morning news conference and pleaded for his help because she feared for her life. This is one of Maldonado's friends and colleagues.
The mechanism for the protection of journalists should have had a patrol car patrolling permanently outside of Lord's home, and they didn't do it. How is it possible that someone can come to kill a person that needs to be protected? The murderer comes, waits for her, then leaves, just like that. How is that possible?
In Turkey, prominent journalist Sedef Kabas has been jailed while she awaits trial on charges of allegedly insulting President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Kabas was detained Saturday after she tweeted a proverb that translates as, "When the ox climbs to the palace, he does not become a king, but the palace becomes a barn," unquote. Kabas is being held at a prison in Istanbul. The law on insulting the president carries a sentence of between 1 and 4 years. Tens of thousands of people have been charged and sentenced over the so-called crime during Erdogan's presidency. London's police commissioner has launched an investigation into breaches of COVID-19 lockdown rules at UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's official residence. The announcement came after ITV News reported Johnson attended an indoor birthday party during the first lockdown in June of 2020. It's the latest in a string of revelations that Johnson repeatedly flouted the strict lockdown rules that he ordered for the rest of the country. This is Keir Starmer, head of the opposition Labour Party.
This is yet more evidence that we've got a Prime Minister who believes that the rules that he made don't apply to him. And so we've got a Prime Minister and a government that spend their whole time mopping up sleaze and deceit.
In Georgia, a judge has granted a request by Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis to convene a special grand jury to investigate former President Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Willis has said she will decide whether to bring criminal charges against Trump during the first half of this year. A key piece of evidence has already been made public. On January 2, 2021, Trump asked Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, to, quote, find enough votes to overturn Joe Biden's margin of victory in Georgia.
So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state.
Last year, Willis said Trump could face criminal charges, including solicitation of election fraud, conspiracy, and racketeering. Meanwhile, Virginia's new Republican attorney general has fired the top attorney for the University of Virginia, a move condemned by Democrats as political retribution. The attorney, Timothy Heapfe, serves as the top staff investigator for the House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Racial justice advocates are condemning the U.S. Supreme Court's decision Monday to hear challenges against the use of affirmative action in college admissions. The cases against Harvard and the University of North Carolina were brought by the conservative group Students for Fair Admissions, founded by the right-wing legal strategist Edward Blum. Though the Supreme Court has previously upheld affirmative action, most recently in 2016, advocates fear the court's conservative majority could strike down racial justice policies that have allowed Black and other students of color to have equal access to higher education. The case will be heard in the Supreme Court's next session, which begins in October. In labor news, some 8,400 unionized King Soopers grocery workers have ended a 10-day strike after members approved a new contract. The 3-year agreement with the Kroger-owned grocery chain brings workers better health care and pension benefits, tougher workplace safety measures, and wage increases of up to $5 per hour. 3/4 of Kroger employees, recently surveyed by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, reported they face food insecurity. Attorneys general from 3 states in the District of Columbia have filed suit against Google, alleging the tech giant deceived customers over their ability to protect their privacy through Google account settings. The lawsuit charges Google has for years deployed software tricks to continuously track a user's location, even when customers thought they'd opted out by turning off the location history setting in Google software. And in Iowa, prosecutors have dismissed a second case against Matt Johnson, an animal rights activist who released footage of hundreds of pigs being euthanized at 2 Iowa pork facilities in early 2020. Johnson is a member of the group Direct Action Everywhere. He secretly recorded video of pigs being killed at 2 pork plants owned by Iowa Select Farms, a major pork producer. The company was unable to send the pigs to slaughterhouses that were closed due to the pandemic, so they killed the pigs by shutting down ventilation in their barns and overheating them. In December of 2020, Matt Johnson made headlines when he posed as the CEO of the pork giant Smithfield Foods and appeared on the Fox Business Channel.
our industry poses a serious threat in effectively bringing on the next pandemic with CDC data showing that three of four infectious diseases come from animals and the conditions inside of our farms can sometimes be petri dishes for new diseases. Hog farming also causes immense harm to our air and waterways.
Afterwards, Fox Business realized they'd been punked. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We'll be right back.
cardboard thing, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Yes, it's only a canvas sky hanging over a muslin tree, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Without your love, it's a honky-tonk parade. Without your love, it's a melody played in the penny arcade. It's a Bonham and Bailey world, just as phony as it can be. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me.
Lovely day to be caught in the rain. going on your way. Now you've got to remain. Just as you were going, leaving me all at sea. The clouds broke, they broke, and oh, what a break for me. I can see the sun up high, though we're caught in the storm. I can see where you and I could be cozy and warm. Let the rain pitter-patter, but it really doesn't matter if the skies are gray. Long as I can be with you, it's a lovely day.
Telling your beloved in the green room that It was 50 degrees yesterday afternoon, and this morning it was 5.
Oh, my God. Talk about whiplash.
It's supposed to be even colder tomorrow morning, but then allegedly by Friday we'll be back up to 45, 50 degrees by Friday. Now, you figure that.
Yeah, I mean, we live in just amazingly careening moments in time here. The weather and the politics, it's, wacky.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm trying to think back. Have I really seen that kind of a swing before? And maybe I'm just more sensitive now than before, but
I'm not aware of it either. Yeah, we had the same, last week we had the same, not quite that radical, but... you know, it was really brutal one day, and the next day it's like high 40s, you know.
A 45-degree swing in less than, literally, it'd be like 18 hours. I mean, it was like 50 degrees in the afternoon. By the morning, it was 5. I don't know. But I don't know. Maybe I'm just, I don't know.
Well, I mean, look at, not only summer fires, and they got winter fires now in California. I mean, there's a huge fire going on right now.
Well, now, John, everybody always thinks of California and wildfires. I think that's because, John, everybody would like to live California. You know, I mean, California, the golden, it's the golden state. I mean, it's Florida.
Yeah, but, I mean, of course, real estate values are famously and consistently tremendously high, but people were finding out like along the Mississippi, you know, people would build in flood zones. I mean, that's the thing where natural, you know, rivers decide to change their direction and where they go, and suddenly people thought they had a wonderful waterfront property are now, you know, the first floor submerged in water in a flood. And climate shifts, you know, and obviously with the fires, and, you know, you built this wonderful ranch house up in the, you know, in the hills with other people, and suddenly, you know, your paradise is now a nightmare and a hell, and you potentially lose your house. You know, shit happens, I guess, what are you going to say, you know? It's terrible.
Well, I just think these, you know, these wonderful sun-soaked dreams with the ocean rolling in on the beach and a bungalow at Malibu all this, you know, I just think it's sort of I mean, I could see myself flipping into that hallucination, you know. As these radical realities come down around us, you know what I mean? It's sort of, the reality is this: I've been out in California. Have you ever really spent any time in California, John?
I was in California once, many, many years ago, and
for two days.
I was in Orange County, and it frightened me. Orange County was so built up with these super big houses, and it was like you were in a humongous apartment house, and you were going from apartment to apartment with your car, you know? It was like... I was going like, oh, my God.
I went out there for about 6 months. And tried to live California, and that's the common expression. You know, you want to live California.
Try to live.
But I went out there, and all I ended up doing was just work, because the cost of living for a rental apartment, like you're talking about, is so high that it's like you have to work all the time. The pay is so crappy.
Well, and of course the dysfunction is showing when they have homeless, hobo villages now all over the place,
I didn't see any of that when I was out there. Now, I did see some, I don't know if you'd call them homeless, stoner hippies out on the beach who lived out on the beach as much as they could.
Right.
I mean, you know, I was always out there trying to buy marijuana from them or something.
Right.
I was trying to, and study them. I was studying them because I would only get to work. I would work like six days a week, and I get one day off. And I'm working two jobs, and it's like the one day a week I have off, I jet propel myself down to the beach and try to score some pot and talk to the hippies who were just bums. And I was very disappointed when I first went to the beach because it smelled like human urine and and feces. It really
not
was
nice.
Like a sewer,
nice.
Yeah, that was my first experience with the California beach. I thought, this is not right. And yeah, it was nice to see the seals. It was nice to see the living seals.
Right.
I'd never seen
a
seal before.
Right.
But it was like in this shit-soaked beach, and I sort of felt sorry.
Oh, my God. That's like where I went swimming in Nha Trang, Vietnam, and a couple of us were, you know, cavorting out in the water, and all of a sudden we realized we're in some sewage slipstream, shit floating by us. We're going, oh, my God, Jesus Christ. You know? Very memorable moment, like, oh, my God.
I never got in the water. You're a better man than I. I just felt sorry for the seals and turned around and went back to my apartment. I just went back to my apartment disgusted.
Found your weed and went back to your apartment.
Yeah, right. I got my cheap weed and went back to my apartment. It only took 6 months and I burned out on that. I said, hell, I'm going to Kansas. I don't have to work as many hours, and it's cheaper to live.
And you returned to Kansas. You know, there's an HBO series.
Yeah, and I
somebody.
And I never lived in California.
Yeah.
Huh?
Okay. Well, there's an HBO series about a woman who's like you returning to Kansas, her home in Kansas.
I
think a lot of people probably leave Kansas and then return, you know, or something like that.
Yeah, she is making big headlines because even the local media is turning her.
Mm-hmm.
The local NPR affiliate is turning her into a celebrity here in Kansas. Bridget Edwards, I think is her name. I'm not sure what her name is.
I don't know. I just saw I missed the one Sunday night, I guess the second one. I missed that, yeah.
Well, I don't have HBO, so it's all a mystery to me. But yeah, I'm sure.
Well, to me, what was? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
It's just the mystery to me is what is the fascination with the rest of the country with living a mediocre life in a mediocre land? I mean, either to me or a banal land, utter boredom. You know, but you've seen an episode. Well, I mean,
I saw the episode, and here's my impression of it was that, this is an idea that I've sort of half-baked generated, you know, because of having a radio show with you in Kansas, this idea that progressive ideas, you know, exist in a far-left progressive politics, of course. But progressive ideas also can rise out of normal situations, and if you don't think of progressivism and progressive liberal ideas as the bailiwick of the far left and the socialist and all that nonsense, but you see them as impulses of life, that what this series is trying to suggest is that, you know, here's a person, you know, quote, returning to Kansas. And as you say, come back to a simpler life, what they were familiar with as a child, et cetera, et cetera. But the point is, it takes place in a religious context. She comes back and she meets this guy. He's kind of a dork, and I think he's gay. And he's assigned in some sort of context to work with her or something. I forget why. And he invites her, well, come on back to this church where they were both choir singers as, younger people. And he says, you know, come back to the church. We have this really cool meeting. I said, ah, the hell with that. I don't do that. And he looks at her and almost winks, and he says, well, you're really going to like this. And so she finally decides to go. And in the context of this group within this church, you know, very important context of church, you realize, my God, these people are gay. They're transgender. They're on the margins. You know, these are marginalized people, and suddenly they're dancing. They're having a wonderful time. They're just acting like normal people. You know, they're enjoying each other, et cetera. There's no overt sexual anything going on here. You know, they just seem to be a little out of it. And the point that I took out of it was, you know, I suppose some conflict will come with this with the church, maybe, and that'll be a dramatic conflict in the piece. But, you know, it's the idea that in a conservative society, a lot of things that are pushed and make it conservative are keeping things simple, keeping them like they were in the past, and all the assumptions we had in the past we keep assuming and all that. Well, life is complex and life moves on and evolves over time, et cetera. And the point here is that life is complex, and they're accepting that within the context of this fundamentalist church. And it seemed to me, you know, kind of an interesting idea, you know, that progressive ideas can evolve out of the soil of very conservative places. I don't know. Again, it's a little half baked, but you know, it was interesting. Anyway, what do you think? I don't.
I have a pet theory. Well, I haven't seen it, and
yeah.
I don't. But I could say I lived some of that.
Well, that's what I mean. You're living in that context yourself. You're an example of that in some ways with your, you know, with your little magazine.
Yeah, my little efforts out here. Yeah, you know, running for office,
right.
All that horse shit.
Right, right. Just an idea.
But yeah, but I have a pet theory about this, and I think the reason that this series, what is the name of it? I don't even know the name. They're talking
somebody.
About
it's
radio.
Just called Somebody Somewhere. I think it's
Somewhere.
Know, very,
yeah.
Somebody, comma Somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, there was I've had this pet theory that where there is the most where there is lack of words, draconian repression. I guess
exactly.
One way of putting it.
Good. That's a good phrase.
There's a resistance, and it flourishes. In places where, in Kansas, it flourishes in places where some of the most basic, simplest things like sexual identity, gender identity, you know, et cetera.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
And that's probably more common. In terms
right,
of
right, but it's usually repressed and kept secret and silent. And
oh God, yeah.
Yeah. Right.
In the white rural areas, and this series takes place in what we out here call an agricultural college. It's actually a university, but it's an agricultural.
Now it's a town called Manhattan. Is that really a real town?
Yeah.
The irony, of course, is called Manhattan, and it's rural. I mean, it's to me a very
ironic. They pimp on billboards calling it the Little Apple. On the billboard, no show. Yeah, I've seen billboards. I lived 20 miles west of Manhattan is Fort Riley, one of the largest.
Okay, sure. A friend of mine was stationed there.
Yeah, one of the largest geographical army bases in the country.
Right.
And it's in square miles. And then 20 miles to the east is where I lived in a small village, and that's where I ran my newspapers for three years, my weekly newspapers out of. I'm very well acquainted with Manhattan, a.k.a. the Little Apple.
Uh-huh.
And
interesting.
And I'd be interested. I'll have to wait until it shows up somewhere else. But maybe it's on HBO. Maybe I'll waste some money and watch it. You know. But right now, I'm mm-hmm. fascinated with the news coverage about the thing and her personality.
I'll watch the second one, and maybe we can talk about it next week. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe we can talk about it. But, I mean, it really is that way. I remember when I was running the papers, I was one of the first newspaper editors to oppose Gulf War I. And mm-hmm. I got people from Manhattan, from Kansas State University, and from the fort at Fort Riley. They would drive and travel all the way out to this little village where I lived at. And I was printing these papers every week, and they were going out of state, and it was like, you know, sort of very unusual that a guy, publisher of two weekly newspapers, was opposing the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, you know, and really straight up. I mean, printing speeches made by people in Kansas City and, you know, people from around the country. And these people would travel out here. One of them was a guy who deserted. Well, I don't know if you'd call it deserted the Army.
Mm-hmm.
He became a conscientious objector while he was in the Army, okay, mm-hmm. against the war. And he started coming out and helping me print the paper every week, you know. Yeah, and then these college kids were coming out. This is, goes along with my theory about resistance and repression. And then there was young people that would come out from the campus at the university, and they would come out every week. Oh, I had a staff. They became staff mm-hmm. people on the newspaper and the printing plant, because we printed it too. We didn't just, you know, mm-hmm. job it out. We actually printed the damn thing on a big mm-hmm. printing press. And it became a real dynamic, social dynamic thing at the printer mm-hmm. Monday and Tuesday when we went to press. And mm-hmm. All these people coming around who I didn't know, eventually the people from Leonard Peltier. He was in prison at that time in Leavenworth. Right. And his people started coming, and we started printing their paper for a while. So my point is that this all started, this is over a 3-year period, and, you know, mm-hmm. 150 some issues. You know, it was weekly. That's why I was talking about it. It wasn't really necessarily the churches, but it wasn't a very, very conservative village town.
Exactly.
Less than 400 people. And it became the printing plant was behind a bar, the local bar.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And people would, non-natives, the GIs that were, you know, opposed to the war, and these kids of the college who were all into long hair and, you know, I guess a 90s version of the 60s, started mm-hmm. coming out to this place, and they would go through the bar, and all these locals would like, roll their eyes and then start, well, what the hell is going on back there? And then the other newspapers started publishing stories about the paper, and then they started going, you know, what the hell is he doing back there? You know, what are they printing?
Right.
You know? And so my point is that resistance grows in the most unlikely places. And it's, you know,
well, I had this feeling about this show that, you know, it was a narrative. It's a story. It's a, you know, regular series story. But that something of that dynamic was going on. That's what made it an interesting story, because the idea that in a very, what did you call it, draconian repressed society, that everything is secret and you're afraid to come out, and, you know, using the idea of coming out in a lot of different contexts, not just in, you know, coming out being gay or anything like that, but coming out being, you know, any kind of, you know, having any kind of progressive sympathies or compassion for people and things like that, you know, that in a harsh, you know, draconian repressed society, you know, the idea of compassion for weaker, poorer people and things like that is to be, you know, not condoned. You need to repress that because, you know, we don't want to have sympathy for poor people. You know, we want to punch down and we want to support rich people and things like that. But, you know, those voices of these repressed people, they want to speak. They want to speak out. And out of that speaking out, you know, you develop narratives of the true complexity of society. And so all these people that were formerly in this repressed society considered boogeymen to keep them down and, you know, demons and all this, suddenly they're humanized. And you realize, my God, these people walk around eating shit just like I do, you know? And you know what I mean? And
Definitely.
I thought there was something like that they were trying to do with this story coming out of Manhattan, Kansas.
Well, that's a real – I mean, to me, I'd be honest. That's a very, in my opinion, a very simplistic type of – you could really stick with that theme as a plot for future shows. But, I mean, it's more developed than that. I mean, in Manhattan, there's a Unitarian – well, there's a peace and justice zone, that's what they call it. And there's a lot of people, there's a Unitarian, quote-unquote, church in that community. And those are places where people could go. And one thing I learned, you're talking about poor people. I advertised, actually, I put in coupons. Started out with just three or four prisoners. Actually, they were my relatives that were in prison, and I started sending my newspapers to them every week, and they wrote letters, and I would print the letters. Now I was printing letters from even people who hated these newspapers, because they're supposed to have news from Blue Rapids and Frankfort, you know, these little communities. I'm printing their newspaper, but I'm putting their news in it, but not near as much. And I'm putting more news about the war and Leonard Peltier and prisoners in Kansas. And these three prisoners took the newspaper, and within like less than a few months, I was up to 100. I made the mistake of saying three to prisoners. In less than a few months, I was up to 127 prisoners in the Kansas prison system.
Wow.
Getting the weekly news. I did not know what I was doing when I did that.
You're a real radical here, man.
Yeah. And I got let. Not really. I really wasn't. I was just trying to be nice to my two brothers that were in prison at the time. And it spread the word. And pretty soon I was printing letters from convicted murderers who were writing about how the guards were. You know, all kinds of exposés of what was going on within the prison system, the Kansas State prison system. And it was really an amazing experience for 3 years. I worked way too hard on it.
To me, this, you know, this idea of, complexity and narrative sort of thing bubbling up out of this idea of draconian repression, as you called it, great term, it is part of what, again, Barack Obama about a couple of months ago suggested, that characterizing the times that we're living in right at this moment as a third reconstruction, because that's what a reconstruction is. You know, you take a repressed society that suddenly has problems and suddenly isn't working as well as it might, you know, because it's holding on to things that against the natural evolution of change in history and all that kind of stuff, that, you know, what a reconstruction is that information sort of bubbling up from below. It's irrepressible, bubbling up from below, you know, in a sense humanizing people in this draconian repression who are demonized to keep them down, that this bubbling up is happening a lot of places. It's happening everywhere, and that's why I think Obama was sharp enough to figure that and use that term, that this is a, you know, a third Reconstruction like the one after the Civil War that was ended up thwarted by the KKK backlash, and then, of course, the one in the 60s that was thwarted by the conservative turn, the rise of Reagan and, you know, putting all that stuff down, the drug war, et cetera, that what these reconstructive periods are a dance between this bubbling up of things and this repressive power from, you know, from top down pushing things back down. And, you know, so I think that's what we're in. So we're seeing a lot of things like this book I just got. You said you made a review of it called Gangsters of Capitalism, Smedley Butler, the Marines, and the Making and Breaking of America's Empire by Jonathan M. Katz. A wonderful book, because I've followed Smedley Butler, you know, the Marine from Quaker Marine from Westchester outside of Philadelphia here, who was a major general and won two Congressional Medals of Honor and, you know, went through Central America, Haiti, Philippines, and all that stuff, you know, ever since he was a 16-year-old second lieutenant at Guantanamo during the Spanish-American War. He got in at 16 because his father and mother, Quakers in Westchester, signed the papers. And his mother, a strong Quaker, was advocated for him as a military man. You know, she was more bloodthirsty than her husband. And so she signed to have this kid become a military person. Well, you know, the left, the Vets for Peace, has used Smedley Butler. In fact, the Boston chapter of Veterans Peace is the Smedley Butler chapter for many, many years. And they use him as this leftist icon. Well, he's not quite that. He was like all of us in Veterans for Peace, you know, we contributed to this imperial thing in Vietnam and all that kind of stuff. And many, many Veterans for Peace members, you know, did some terrible things during, and they are now opposing it as a veteran for peace. Well, he's a classic of that because, you know, in Haiti, for instance, he, incredibly racist. I've read of his accounts there. And, you know, he was, you know, doing things that basically enslaved the Haitians. And when they, you know, when they fought in the Philippines, this account here, which, you know, I've read several accounts of this guy's life, but the point is, you know, they were slaughtering people by the tens of thousands at times. And, you know, this was, he calls, the making and breaking of America's empire. This was the making of America's empire in about 1898 when young Smedley wanted to go out and perform for his country imperially, because America was bursting at the seams, you know, the railroads, et cetera, you know, America was just, you know, it couldn't contain itself. Its buttons were bursting. It was bursting at the seams. So really, after the Civil War, the industrial rise of industrialism was just incredible. You know, as I say, now there's a series on HBO, The Gilded Age, which is a soap opera about all these very, very wealthy, imperial, cigar-smoking, you know, people, like J.P. Morgan's on the cover of this book, Gangsters of Capitalism. And, you know, these people were ruthless, and they sent people to these areas of the benighted parts of the world, like the Philippines, which was under the control of the Spanish, and, you know, they knocked the Spanish out right away. But then this guy Aguinaldo came and had some independence aspirations for the Philippines. Well, we weren't going to buy that at all. We wanted to own the Philippines as our first imperial possession. And so we accumulated a half a dozen, 10 islands from Puerto Rico and whatnot. And some of the, like in the Philippines especially, that's where waterboarding was first introduced, very controversially. And, you know, the slaughter was just massive and ruthless and racist as it comes. And Smedley Butler participated in all this. But then he got sick of it. He got sick of it, again, I think rooted in his Quakerism, and he basically outed it. It helped that they passed him over for head of the Commandant of the Marines because he didn't go to military school. He started as a 16-year-old, you know, avoiding Spanish snipers on Guantanamo. And so he was a soldier, and so they passed him over, and he was all pissed off. They also late in his life, they as major general, they court-martialed him for dissing Mussolini. You know, he was, you know, we were supporting Mussolini at that time in the 20s, and Cornelius Vanderbilt II had accompanied as a journalist, the son of the famous, you know, capitalist. He was a journalist, and he was accompanying Mussolini in his car with, I think, a driver was driving it, and they ran over a child, literally, they ran over a child who was, you know, watching the great man's car come through a village or something. And, you know, the car just kept on going. And and Cornelius Vanderbilt said, "What the fuck, man? Whoa, 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 whoa. You just..." And he apparently, Mussolini slapped him on the knee and said, "Boy, never look back." And and Smedley Butler, at a speech in Philadelphia, you know, a Marine major general damned Mussolini for this story. And Stimson, the Secretary of the Army, court-martialed him, demanded that he apologize to Mussolini. And he said, "Fuck it, I'm not apologizing to that pig." And they court-martialed him. Well, he then took it to the road and went around the country making speeches. And so humiliated Stimson, and they had to back off, and they dropped the charges. And so then he became he wrote a little pamphlet called War is a Racket, and said, "I was a gangster for capitalism and the Brown Brothers Bank in New York and Wall Street down when I was in Nicaragua and Honduras and all that kind of stuff." And he said, "I could have taught Al Capone a thing or two, boy. We knew what to do." And he then became this angry person that went around the country running down U.S. military imperialism very effectively. Then he dies in 1940, late 1940, a year, 9 months before Pearl Harbor. If Smedley Butler had lived, you know, into World War II, I have no doubt whatsoever that he would have changed his tune, and because of the Japanese attack, he would have supported the war effort. But he's sort of frozen in amber because he dies before Pearl Harbor. So he's frozen in amber as this person who writes this book called War is a Racket. And so it's a great, great story. Again, he's become an icon of the left, which, you know, may be a little skewed and wrong, but he's certainly taken a moral stand against U.S. military imperialism, in the 30s. And so it's interesting that this book just lays it all out in a way that's really mainstream, because he's been, in this sort of militarist, imperialist, if you're using your term, draconian, repressed environment, Smedley Butler's story was never really mainstream. It was held by, you know, radical anti-war leftist veterans like me and things like that. But his story wasn't, you know, didn't bubble up into the mainstream because it was attacking the whole idea of American imperialism. Well, I'm saying in this Reconstruction moment we're living in, this book is just another bubbling up, because this book is very mainstream, and he's very cleverly not turned it into a book about Smedley Butler so much, although it virtually is, but he's titled it Gangsters of Capitalism with a subtitle.
I know. That's,
and he's
that's
got J.P. Morgan up there and a couple other cutthroats in their beaver hats, you know, tall beaver hats. I mean, looking like they'd rip your intestines out and jump rope with them if they could, you know. And so he's, you know, again, I think this bubbling up of information about the realities of American imperialism and the ruthlessness and the slaughter that went down, you know, in some of these places. And it was, you know, it was kept secret pretty much to American people. You know, you don't need to know this, but you're benefiting from it, you know. And so, again, this, but Vladimir Putin also knows this is going on, right? So there's a story in the Times today, an op-ed by Fiona Hill, who testified in all that stuff, you know, and she was in U.S. intelligence and all that kind of stuff, that, you know, Putin is just this grinning son of a bitch. Just, he has us exactly where he wants us. He knows there's this bubbling up reconstruction going on in America, and he's angry because the Soviet Union was driven into a ditch in 1989 and the 90s, and he's saying, well, now it's your turn. You're being driven into a ditch.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
and so,
you got that right, but
and I think he this is true. I mean, Vladimir Putin is a son of a bitch, and I'm not defending him, but he knows what's going on. And not that it's going to be exactly like the Soviet Union, but the point is the United States is on the ropes, and its imperial history is becoming, bubbling up more and more, becoming an issue. It's like you can't hide from this anymore. And
Well, since the advent of the neoliberal defense, I mean, or attack on Donald Trump, I mean, that's something I don't think people understand, is that, you know, it's the, by demonizing Trump and Putin, I think a lot of people are. I think that's one of the problems, and what we're seeing now in the media and everything with this drive towards war, with, you know,
right?
The
media becomes stupid. You know, that's the problem. Yeah.
I mean,
everybody wants simplicity. Everybody wants it simple. It's not simple, and it's very messy. You know.
Yeah,
and Vladimir Putin has a good point. Like, what the fuck are all you people in Eastern Europe on our border with bombs and stuff? You know, wait a minute. Okay, I know you've been doing it for 75 years, but wait a minute. It's a fact of life, and we don't like it. Well, because the momentum in the United States is not going to give up. You know,
you call it momentum?
Well, the 75 years of momentum of the Cold War opposing the Soviet Union, yes. I mean, this is not, I mean,
the
opposite, the obverse is not true. In other words, Russia put put missiles in Cuba, yes. But they had no history, a 75-year history, of missiles in Mexico and Cuba, et cetera, all around the United States, right? But there is that history vis-a-vis the Soviet Union and Russia. And so that's, you know, I think Putin does have a case here, argument that, wait, I'm fed up with this, and you guys are on the ropes, and you guys are weakening like you weakened us in the 90s and 80s, and I'm not going to let you go on this. You know, I'm going to squeeze you every way I can because, you know, again, but the United States is not going to budge because it's, you know, its whole history is based on being anti-Soviet in the Cold War and all that. So all I'm saying, it's very, very messy. And, but that both sides, you know, you could argue like anything, both sides, you know, have an argument. So that's why we get to the potential war here. And you hope that maybe smarter, you know, heads will prevail. Yeah.
But are you saying that they haven't been demonizing? First, yes, for 70 mm-hmm. plus years they demonized communism.
Of course.
And now, I think it's a shift towards demonizing Putin and the guy who's out of China. And I think there, you know,
it's out of fear. The United States is weakening.
This is
the
policy of empire. Don't you think this is
still,
at least it's not the policy, it's propaganda of empire. It's still the propaganda of empire.
I don't disagree with any of that. Yeah, absolutely. But what I think we forget is that I think Putin is very much future oriented in this sense, that the new world, the globalized world, with the rise of the internet and all this, and the diminishing of the nation state and the rise of power centers and things like that, this new world. So now what we're seeing is a struggle, a neo-struggle, a new struggle for a new brand of imperialism in the world. There was European colonialism. There was American imperialism. Now I'm saying there's a new struggle in the world under the internet and all the rise of technology, et cetera, blah, 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 that there's, you know, China is colonizing Africa like you wouldn't believe. And so there is a new struggle for imperialized power in the world that is based on different categories than with the European colonialism and British and United States imperialism. Now, maybe this is a lot of hogwash to people, but there is something to this idea that there is a new struggle for, you know, in other words, nations that are bursting at the seams like the United States was in the between the Civil War in 1898 and the turn of the century. So it was reaching out. Well, China, if there's anybody, any nation in this world that is bursting at the seams, popping its buttons, that it's just so bursting at the seams, is China, for God's sakes. And so China is in an expansive imperialistic mode because it just is, you know, it's rolling so well in some ways.
I don't agree.
Well, maybe I'm overstating it to make a point, but, you know, I'm just trying to, you know, make a point.
Well, you're talking about competing global interests.
Yeah.
I mean, I mean, I think the imperialism that we've seen in the last, the people of the world have seen in the last 150, 200 years, if not longer,
mm-hmm.
You know, has been like Smedley Butler portrayed.
Right.
It was blatant, and it had no benefit other than conquest of territory.
You're not going to get an argument on me, Mike. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't think this is. I think this is a more subversive, if you will, form of. If you want to use the word imperialism, but I think mm-hmm. it's sort of, in my opinion, it's they're beating us at our own game, but they're doing it in a way which is not near as bloody, and not near mm-hmm. as rapist. You know,
you're absolutely right. And of course, U.S. imperialism wasn't the same as the Belgian Congo. I mean, we never, you know, slaughtered people like they did
We slaughtered. I know for a fact Mark Twain wrote about it, about slaughtering Filipinos in a volcano crater. You know, I read that in high school, and I was very hard to find.
I was just reading about
it.
It's in this book, yes, indeed.
Oh, well, Twain wrote about it, and they, you know, and I did not even, you know, but that's just as bloody as fucking Belgian Congo. It's horrible.
Look.
And I don't see that yet with the Chinese. And with the Russians, what are they?
No. I never said the Chinese were slaughtering.
No, I'm not.
People.
It's not you and me. It's not you against me. I'm just trying to point out to the listeners, because I think the listeners hear this kind of talk, and it's like I don't think the forces for peace in this country, especially, aren't capable of communicating the nuance of geopolitical strategies in a way where
I think you're right.
Where we're just automatically attacked as being communists. I mean, because
and a lot of to be a little sarcastic, a lot of the far left peace movement reduces to a bumper sticker of, hey, mean people suck. It's like, right. I mean, life is messy always, but my view is that American imperialism was not as overtly bloody, if you will, as some examples, a lot of examples of British and the Belgians in the Congo were the worst of the worst. Slaughtered people by the millions, exploiting them for labor and things like that. I think the U.S. cleaned up the Colonial Imperial Act, but of course when it first entered it in the Philippines in 1898 and then the wars in the early 03s, 04s, 05s in the Philippines, there was tremendous amount of violence against those people. And in fact, Duterte, it's accounted for in this book, Duterte is using this to the max. You know, the dictator in the Philippines now, who's very anti-American and is playing the U.S. off of China. He's buying into China. And they have annual ceremonies exploiting, the abuses that the Americans did to the Philippines, these massacres. This guy witnessed them, where they go and the Americans, and in fact, there's a movie which I've seen about Goya Boy General during the wars with the United States about this young general, in which the author of this book happens to be there, and he plays a U.S.-American prisoner to these in this movie. Right, and so in the Philippines, the American abuses to the Philippines, 1898 through 1906 or something, were egregious, and they have not forgotten them. And especially now, with the decline of American power and the rise of China, that the Philippines, this Asian island archipelago, is leaning towards China, and the U.S. is just barely holding on, Trump liked Duterte, of course, because he was a tyrant and, liked to murder people, and so... I don't know. It's just a lot of interesting stuff going on. And,
well, it is that.
What more can you say?
It is that. And you're talking about the top, right?
Right.
You're talking about the top of our society.
I'm speculating here. I'm asking people to think.
You're talking about the top of Russia, the top of China, the top of the U.S., the people who are, punching down always.
Fair enough.
People,
yeah.
Around the world, But I just tend to think that we're not capable. But I think that what's wrong with the anti-war movement in this country right now has been, the lack of a capacity to talk about the nuances because there was a guy who was a very right-wing caller on C-SPAN this morning who called in and pointed out, I don't know if he's right-wing, he called on the Republican line, and he said, he pointed out the people in the Crimea voted plebiscite over and over to separate and to stay in the borders of Russia, and they did
while
Ukraine was. But why do we throw that out the window? Because
I don't think
the
we
Russians
should.
Are piling tanks up on the border. It's almost like, has anybody thought that maybe the Ukrainians, after getting over $2 billion in weaponry from the United States alone. And from NATO countries. And now Joe Biden promised that $200 million more weapons going there.
And Johnson in Britain sending them stuff. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, has anyone? Why isn't anyone in the New York Times, the old gray egg, the old gray lady, Why aren't they reporting on those things as maybe Ukraine is thinking of attacking the Crimea, and that in fact has been doing so for since they voted themselves out of Ukraine.
Yeah.
I mean,
well,
I'm not sure that's
not mentioned, but it may be mentioned in paragraph 14 in a big story or something. It's not emphasized. But I think you're right. And our friend Dave Lindorf would agree 100% with this. I can't speak for Dave, but I think he would, that, the Russians have a damn good argument, especially in a place like Crimea. I mean, if you read Solzhenitsyn, I think it's Solzhenitsyn as a young soldier, he fought in Crimea. I mean, the Russians are deeply involved in Crimea, and it's all part of the warm water port. They need a warm water port and all that kind of stuff. So we have arguments, the Monroe Doctrine, that we own, the Caribbean and the get out of the Caribbean, get out of Central America and all this. It's like, well, the Russians are not that far off. They feel the same way about a place like Crimea. And, it depends on, I suppose if you're a true ideal Democrat and believe in democracy, that somehow there should be a vote that one person, one vote, that the people of Crimea get to decide. But the way the nature of democracy and the way bullshit flies around in this internet world, you can't have that kind of perfect democracy anymore because there's so much horseshit flying around that, don't you think? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, I'm laughing. Yes.
Horseshit storms, I don't know.
What do your anti-war comrades say? I can't use the word comrades because they're good. What are they saying about this Ukraine, this push,
I know in the past, I used to get into little arguments on the emails with some of these guys from Vets for Peace and other lists. Especially with Assad. It was Putin and Assad. Putin was poor, misunderstood Vladimir Putin. We misunderstand the poor guy, And he's really a nice guy. They love him. He's a pure Democrat, and all of his, people vote for him. They love. And I'm going like, hold up, slow the fuck down, And that's not true. I mean, it's complicated, I grant you that, but then the same people would defend Assad the same way, Again, Assad is completely misunderstood. Yeah. Well, he may be misunderstood, but he's also a murdering son of a bitch, Let's get real. And so some of these anti-war people were so willfully simplistic that the U.S. had to be so bad because the U.S., we've been running the U.S., you and I have been running the U.S. down, imperialism, horrible, horrible things. And because the U.S. is so bad, therefore, Assad and Vladimir Putin have to be good. No, it does not work that way. Everybody's bad.
Go back. What was the name of the book and who wrote it?
It's a great book. I highly recommend it. I'm going to do a review for it. I got a little bit of reading to go. It's called Gangsters of Capitalism, subtitle Smedley Butler, the Marines, and the Making and Breaking of America's Empire by Jonathan M. Katz. And it is K-A-T-T. It doesn't sweet talk Smedley Butler into this, nice guy. My friend Bill Earhart, a Marine, says who taught him out at Haverford School, where he taught, where Smedley went to as a quarterback in high school. He says Smedley Butler was kill crazy, a Quaker who was supported in all his violent imperial efforts by his mother. She threatened people if they gave him a hard time, and he talked in letters to her about killing people and all this stuff, and she was go on, yeah. And she supported him, a mother's support for all this stuff. But he then realized, and I think it's a Quaker background, that he wasn't buying this. He just, in the end, he criticized his own actions, basically, as Veterans for Peace do, as, I do, because, I can't condone what I did in Vietnam. It was stupid. Yeah, go ahead.
Right, but we've only got a minute or two. But yeah, at what point in his career, it was when he came back, or why he was in the Philippines?
Well, he came back, and he was in World War One. He did a little, I'll be quick, but he came back. He was, for 2 years, he was given a leave from the Marine Corps to be the police commissioner in Philadelphia. And he finally quit. He said, I can't do this. Because he would be, it was about prohibition. He was going to clean the city out. And they kept saying, no, Smedley, no, you're not supposed to raid that place. That's our place, And and so finally he said, it's so goddamn corrupt, he quit. He just quit and went back to the Marine Corps. So he has a feeling, especially late in his life, against corruption. He can identify this is where corruption comes. He had nothing against killing people. He's not a pacifist at all.
Right.
In fact, arguably, they would be drunk, and he's very famously at a drunken thing got the Marine World and Globe insignia carved into his chest. It's like a foot high thing in his chest. So he was really into this stuff. But, in a drunken whorehouse in the Philippines with some, in the corner, some guy carving his chest when he's drunk, this is Smedley Butler, But I met Stanley McChrystal, the general, once, and I mentioned Smedley Butler. He knew all about Smedley Butler. He admired Smedley Butler, And so Smedley Butler is admired by, American military killers, if you will, and American anti-war pacifists. Everybody owns him. Everybody thinks they own this guy. But he's much more complicated than that. And this book covers that complexity.
Amazing.
All right, Mike.
Origins of Capitalism.
Take care.